Welcome everyone. I'm Rob Olson with the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We are a non-for-profit organization dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the DFW area. I want to thank everybody for coming out on this cold and blustery day. We meet the second and the fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May. And so, always we ask, do we have any first-time visitors? Yes, okay, happy to hear about it, sir.
I got an email from some friends.
Okay, some philosophical friends, right?
History.
Okay, very good. Who else? Yes, sir.
Then I found it through the meetup group.
Okay, through the meetup group. Okay, yeah. Wonderful. Yes, anyone else back there? Oh, yes, sir.
I came across your website.
Okay, you came across our website. Okay, and you're from France, right?
Yes.
You're a Frenchman. Okay. What other nationalities do we have here? Any Americans? Yes. I was talking to Dr. Patterson, and he and I both teach at UTV, and we were talking about how we have just students all over the world, and half their names I can't pronounce, but it's very, very exciting. So, yes. Oh, so I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm from India.
Okay, you're from India. Okay, fantastic. Okay, so if you haven't paid already, our treasurer is David Drum in the back there. So if you came in before he did, then you can just pay him $5 after the lecture. We would appreciate that. We consider that a fantastic bargain. And students with an ID can attend for $2. Any students? Unless we have some slightly older students. Every once in a while we'll get a high school student. That's pretty exciting. If you want to become subscribed to the conference, it's $35 for 6 months. And also, I just want to remind everyone to pay for your meal and your drinks before you leave. Every once in a while, someone might forget, and then we're stuck with the tab. And we're a non-profit organization and not in a position of paying for attendees' meals. So I passed out 2 weeks ago, and today we passed out our spring schedule, and I just want to give a couple plugs to some of our speakers. A couple of them are in the room tonight. We're excited about that. We have talks on utilitarianism. Steve Slurbeck, PhD, chair of the philosophy department from SMU, he's going to be speaking on that topic. We have a political science professor from SMU, Gianna Engler. She's going to be speaking on Critics of Democracy, Ancient and Modern. And I had a chance to visit with her at the boat. She just sounds really like she's going to be a fantastic speaker. John Mears, a history professor at SMU, a professor emeritus, will be speaking on the nature of creativity. Fred Grinnell. Fred is here tonight, I think, PhD. Is Fred here? Yes, Fred. He's spoken with us several times, and he is an amazing speaker, PhD at UT Southwestern. And what is your PhD in Fred? Some aspect of biology, right?
Biochemistry.
Been speaking on discovery and everyday practice of science and on unintended experiments. Lita Lieberman, another philosophy professor from SMU, is going to be speaking on Confederate monuments, problematic politicians, and sexist art, so we're hoping to have a really good turnout that night. And then Cliff Eubanks, a software developer, really a talented guy, is going to be speaking on a local response for emerging threats to democracy. And then Randall McKellar, Randall, can you raise your hand? He's going to be speaking on the conflict paradox and on human behavioral matrices and the tension between our sense of community and our need for conflict as both a prime motivator for our success and the secret cause of our destruction. So we're looking forward to that. So lots of variety. So why attend the Dallas Philosophers Forum? Does philosophy only belong in the halls of academia? No, it belongs in the lives of everyone. It helps us solve our problems, mundane or abstract, and it helps us make better decisions by developing our critical thinking skills. And that's how the father of philosophy, Socrates, that was his whole shtick, if you will. Philosophy teaches a number of skills that are valuable in a variety of professions. The hallmark of philosophy education is critical thinking and inductive reasoning. Additionally, philosophy demonstrates that problems often have multiple causes and multiple solutions. and teaches us to approach problems from a number of different perspectives. The key point to remember is that philosophy is not a collection of facts to be memorized. It is a methodological approach to thinking and problem solving, which is highly valued in our society. Bertrand Russell said, science is what you know, philosophy is what you don't know. In addition, we have a website that has much of the same information. Ken Sauer is a fantastic AV gentleman and our webmaster. He keeps it up to date. You can sign up for our email list on our website. We also have Meetup. We have updates on Meetup, and Skip Kilmer is on the board, also handles that very well. You can sign up for updates on Meetup on our website. So tonight, our speaker will be talking for 45 minutes or so. Approximately, we'll open up for questions. And once again, we ask you to give one or two short statements and then get to your question. And then also, please turn off your cell phones and put them on vibrate mode at this time. I'm really excited, and we're very pleased to have Dr. David Patterson from UTD with us tonight. He holds the Hillel A. Feinberg Distinguished Chair in Holocaust Studies. He played football at Odessa Permian High School in the 60s. What was your position?
I was a middle guard.
Middle guard, okay, all right. Defense and offense?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Patterson, that's why we chose. We want a football star here. Dr. Patterson decided to study philosophy. This is probably the last time he's going to speak for our group. He decided to study philosophy and comparative literature in an effort to engage the big questions. With the degrees in philosophy and in comparative literature from Oregon, he got his bachelor's in Oregon and a PhD, a master's in Oregon. He has taught at the University of Memphis, as well as Oklahoma State University and the University of Oregon. He served as a visiting second chair of the humanities at the University of Oklahoma and as a guest professor at Pepperdine University. His current research interests include ways in which literature articulates the ineffable and how photography reveals the invisible in the context of the Holocaust and inscriptions on Holocaust monuments, memorials, and museums, and the question of how the meaning of the Holocaust, if there is one, is encrypted in those inscriptions. In the research, study, and scholarship, Dr. Patterson encourages his students to work on topics that transform them into witnesses and help them to meet their responsibility to humanity for elevating this world. He joined the University of Texas at Dallas in June of 2010. He will be speaking tonight about the life of Ivan Ilyich, based on the wonderful Tolstoy novel. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. David Patterson.
Need to get that file changed. Thanks so much, Rob. Am I on?
You're on. Okay.
Yes, I'm going to speak about a famous work by Tolstoy, the Death of Ivan Ilyich. Who's read The Death of Ivan Ilyich? Most of you, perhaps? Has anyone read Tolstoy's Confession? Short piece? War and Peace, Anna Karenina. All of these works pertain. Rob mentioned Socrates, and I have a line from Socrates to begin my remarks. Socrates says in the Republic, each of us, neglecting all other studies, should seek after and study this thing, the ability to distinguish the life that is good from the life that is bad. That's what The Death of Ivan Ilyich is about. Now, Leo Tolstoy, as a reminder, was born in 1828, died in 1910. He is the author, of course, of War and Peace, published in 1869, Anna Karenina in 1877. And Most significantly, or among the most significant works he ever wrote, I think, is his Confession of 1879. Now, here's a man, 1879, he's 51 years old. He has already written two novels and many, many, many other works that would have gained him a permanent place in the annals of world literature. One of the wealthiest men in Russia, a member of the aristocracy, Count Leo Tolstoy. He had a family, large family, huge estate. Everything that we're taught we should aspire to, he had attained. And yet, at the age of 50, he came to the conclusion that his life was empty, meaningless. He had accomplished nothing. Now, if you read Anna Karenina, the story of Levin is very much a reflection of Tolstoy's own wrestling in that in those years from 1872 to 1877. Levin, in the novel, kind of works it out, but Tolstoy, the author, didn't quite work it out. Here's Tolstoy, who was afraid to be left alone in a room with a rope, afraid to go hunting by himself. And this is not someone who was afraid of death. Tolstoy was in battles in the military. Tolstoy was once mauled by a bear and nearly killed. He's not afraid of death. He's afraid of how death undercuts meaning in life. And he writes in the Confession, what if I should become as famous as Shakespeare, Gogol, you know, one of the greats? Eventually, if everything turns to ash, eventually the earth itself will be swallowed up by the sun. What's the point? Where is meaning? And he realized ultimately, in the Confession, that the task that confronted him was to leave off with equating infinite equals infinite, finite equals finite. He has to find a way to see how finite equals infinite, how the finite can contain the infinite. He came to realize something that some of those of us who have children perhaps at one moment realize. When you hold your baby, it's 5 seconds old, and you gaze into those eyes, you realize that the infinite comes in small packages. That's what he realized. And in the Confession, he lays out the scenario for the death of Ivan Ilyich. In the Confession, he writes, "It happened with me as it happens with everyone who contracts a fatal internal disease. At first, there were insignificant symptoms of an ailment, which the patient ignores. Then, these symptoms appear more frequently until they merge into one continuous duration of suffering. The suffering increases, and before he can turn around, the patient discovers what he already knew. The thing he had taken for a mere indisposition is in fact the most important thing on earth for him. It is in fact death." Now, when we read a literary text, very often we should take a look at the names of the characters. The names of characters in many literary texts are not random. Ivan is John, which is Yochanan, which means the grace of God. Ilyich means son of Ilya. Ilya is a Russian version of Elijah, the prophet. So his Ilyich is the prophet, Eliyahu, Elijah, And Ivan, the name's by the grace of God. This will play out in the text, in the tale. Now, I call this the life of Ivan Illich because it seems to me that this is the tale not of dying, but of coming to life. He had chosen in the course of his life, like we all do, followed all of the advice of his college counselors. He did everything right. He had chosen the formula for a so-called good life, when in fact, he was choosing a spiritual death. I'll just go to cut to the chase right now. The death of Ivan Illich is not his demise. It's the counterfeit that he had mistaken for life. He had been living the death all along. So this is not a tale. This tale is often read as, oh, all the stages of death and dying are here. In fact, the stages of death and dying are not there if you read it closely. I mean, the stages of death and dying are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. He doesn't go to, he doesn't bargain. Who's he going to bargain? He gets depressed, but in the end, it's not acceptance, it's realization. So I think, in my opinion, this clinical psychological analysis of the text, of the character, is a way of avoiding exactly what he's confronting us with. The death that's mistaken for life. Now, when the tale opens with the line, Ivan Illich is dead. His colleague, he's a judge, right? He has attorneys and judges as colleagues, and the thought goes through their head, he's the one, he's dead, not me. Only others lie in the cemetery. Death has nothing to do with me. We're told that his best friend, Schwartz, wouldn't allow the occasion of the death to interfere with his card game. Right? Other friends are worried about the implications for their promotion. Gee, Ivan's out. Maybe I'll get promoted up. So they're thinking in terms of how death of their friend might, one, interfere with their diversions, or two, have implications for their material promotion. Thinking in terms of property, basically. They go through the motions of the proper way to react following the script, as Ivan himself had done. Ivan Illich had clung to all the formulas of social propriety. He wasn't a juvenile delinquent. He didn't cheat on his wife. He went to the right law school. He got the right job as a judge. He married the girl with the proper breeding. He lived in the right neighborhood. He did everything according to what he was advised. And indeed, as someone who comes from academia, I can tell you that how do we sell academia? How do we sell college education? We don't put it this way, but basically, come here and we'll give you the skills to plunder the world of its goods. we'll give you power. Knowledge is power. And we're told that as a judge, whenever someone came before him, Ivan Illich took pleasure in the power he had over their lives. A word from him could decide the rest of their lives. Ivan Illich bought into the path of the four P's, as I call it: power, prestige, possession, and pleasure. He enjoyed having power over others. He treated, in Martin Buber's terms, he treated other human beings as a it, never as a you, as a thou. If you know, I am thou, Martin Buber. People were objects to be manipulated. They were goods turned over to a market of exchange, as he himself was. So you have this confusion, for example, between being and having. The more I have, the more I am. The more power I have, the more prestige I have, the more possessions I have, the more pleasure I have, the better my life, the more I am, the more substance I have. But of course, as he accumulates more and more of these things, he's beggared by his abundance. He's emptied by it. As I had to work in the Talmud somewhere, as the Talmud teaches us, blessing does not fall upon what can be weighed, measured, or counted. Meaning, sanctity, holiness, what there is to love, lies in what eludes the eye. It doesn't lie in anything you can observe, or grasp, or lay claim to. Indeed, what is sacred lays claim to us, reaches out for us. He reflects on his life as he was young. He went to college. Most of us here perhaps have been to college. Perhaps some of us have been in fraternities or sororities or around fraternities and sororities. I'll just spill my own guts. Some of us have gone through the sex, drugs, and rock and roll period. Ivan Illich went through that. But he comments saying, everything was done with clean hands, in clean undershirts, with French phrases, and most importantly, in the highest society, consequently with the approval of people of the highest standing. I'm cool. But notice the French phrases, the foreign word, the alien word. Indeed, his wife doesn't call him Ivan. She calls him Jean. And indeed, in Russian high society in the 19th century, French was the language of social engagement. French was the language of the Russian court. Right? And as he says in the confession, that it's everything he was doing, and this parallels, the confession parallels Ivan Illich in many ways. He says everything he did it was driven by a desire to be better, not in my own eyes, or in the eyes of God, but in the eyes of those in authority. I got to sell myself. I want to please those in power. I want to please those who can do something for me. It's not what can I do for you, it's pleasing those who can do something for me. This reminds me of another story from the Talmud. One of the great rabbis of the first century, Yohanan ben Zakkai, lay dying. And his disciples gathered around him and said, Rabbi, can you give us a blessing before you pass on to the next world? And he said, may you fear God more than you fear men. And they all said, what? Of course. Yeah, of course we fear God more than men. They looked at him and said, do you? Do you really? Not such an easy thing. Think of the times, and here I'm still in my guts. Think of the times when we kind of pull something and think, no one can see me. I'm okay. Someone can see me at every hour. So, Ivan is doing everything to surround himself with the trappings of the proper life, of propriety, of the so-called good life, social standing, respect, admiration, and so on. And he's finally got this perfect home, his part, his perfect. He's got to make. He just has to adjust a curtain. He slips on the ladder, bumps himself. And he comments, it's a good thing I'm a bit of an athlete. Ordinary man might have killed himself. But he's outfitting his fortress to look like a home. This reminds me of the poem called September 1st, 1939 by W.H. Auden. We all know what happened on September 1st, 1939, the invasion of Poland. And Auden ends the poem like this. This is Ivanovich. He says, faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspire to make this fort a zone, the furniture of the home. Lest we should see where we are. Lest we should see where we are. Lost in a haunted wood. Children afraid of the night who have never been happy or good. This is the quiet desperation in which so many live. This is the quiet desperation in which Ivan Illich lives and from which he will be awakened. Now, he doesn't get better, as you recall. And he begins a process of what I call wrestling with the angel of death. Now the angel of death, I mean, he doesn't himself say it was the angel of death, but he's wrestling, as I say, with the angel of death. The angel of death, as in Jewish tradition, is called the angel with a thousand eyes. The angel is covered with eyes. And it happens that the angel will visit us, not to necessarily take us now, but to leave us with a new set of eyes. So that we've come to see things differently. You have a brush with death. If you're paying attention, you see things a little differently. Very often. We're also taught that the angel, what does the angel of death look like? The angel of death is a mirror of our own soul. To some of us, the angel looks like a being filled with kindness, love, beauty. To others of us, the angel looks like the portrait of Dorian Gray. And of course, our soul, as in the portrait of Dorian Gray, takes on the image of our being. Is dressed in our deeds. So he begins to realize that something is taking place inside of him. He engages the angel of death, not in the process of dying, I would say, but in the process of coming to life for the first time in his life. And he sees how this plays out as he becomes a patient. Much like defendants had stood before him, he's before the doctor. The doctor who treats him like a specimen, like a hit. Like, as it says in the text, as he had treated others in court. So this further isolates him. One of the great modern rabbis, Joseph Soloveitchik, says that in our time, there's an either-or that confronts us concerning the human being. A human being is either a specimen or a child of God. Ivan Illich is a specimen, treated as a specimen, and further isolated. The more he's treated as a specimen, the more distant he is from any human relation. So the one who had lived in the radical isolation of his ego becomes radically isolated from the people around him. And he's turned over to a despair here that is something like what Kierkegaard describes as the sickness unto death. The sickness unto death is not that you're going to die, but you can't die. That you continuously die the death. And indeed, just by the way, when the first human is warned that if you eat this fruit, you will surely die, the Hebrew phrase is "mot tamut," that you will die the death. Not that you will surely die, you will die the death. You will be turned over to a despair in which death is never the last, but continually the last. So, he knows it's a lie. He's literally surrounded by a lie. And this is his greatest torment. The text says, Ivan Illich's torment was the lie. This lie tortured him. It tortured him that they did not want to acknowledge what they all knew, what he knew, and wanted to lie to him about his terrible condition, and even wanted to force him to take part in the lie. The lie must reduce this terrifying event of his death to the level of their visits, their curtains, their sturgeon for dinner. That was the horrible torment that faced Ivan Illich. So finally, he's colliding with the lie that he had lived, the lie that has lived all around him, he slowly begins to ask, how should I live? It occurs to him, maybe I have not lived as I should, but how can that be? He's not Al Capone. He's not a gangster. He's not a criminal. He has followed every rule. And whenever whenever he would ask himself, whenever he would consider, maybe I haven't lived as I should, he at least... He shakes that off. That can't be it. That can't be it. That can't be it. Just look at my CV. That can't be it. Slowly, part of this movement of return, his reflections take him back to his childhood. To the time before he was corrupted, you might say. Before he had bought into what turned out to be the deadly fixed formulas and ready answers of how to live, what one ought to do. It reminds me of, that there's a teaching in the Talmud that says, as when a soul is about to enter this realm, the angel Gabriel teaches that soul all of Torah. And what we have to do, and then gradually, as we are in the world, corrupted by the world, we start to forget Torah. And I was studying a Mishnah this morning about Sukkot, feast of the tabernacles, and it says that one of the sages had a grandchild, and as soon as the grandchild was born, the rabbi took the grandchild into a sukkah so the grandchild wouldn't forget the Torah concerning the sukkah too quickly after, upon entering this world. But those of us who have been around small children know that we have a lot to learn from them. It reminds me, when my grown daughter was like 3 or 4 years old and was learning Hebrew, learning to speak a little Hebrew, she asked me, what does Adonai mean? Adonai, it means Lord, but I said, it's Adonai is a Hebrew word that we use to refer to God. And she paused for a second and she said, I thought every Hebrew word referred to God. Yes. She still had retained a little of that Torah that the angel had taught her. So Ivan Illich goes back to his childhood. He remembers the innocence of his childhood, the vision of his childhood, and it opens him to behold another, you know, human relation, which comes to him through the peasant, Gerasim. The name Gerasim is a young, vibrant peasant, but the name Gerasim means venerable elder, a sage. In the confession, Tolstoy says that the peasants know much more about life than we do. He may be, you know, idolizing the peasant, but he knew peasants very well. They know more about life than we do because they're not afraid of death. They don't flee in the face of death. Whereas we go out kicking and screaming, they understand that this is part of life. So Gerasim is the only one, it says in the tale, that didn't lie. He understands that Ivan Illich is dying. He says, it's God's will. We all come to it. Each of us has our hour. The others are thinking, it's him, not me. Gerasim is the thing that comes to all of us. Gerasim knows what must be done. If you know Anna Karenina, you remember that Levin is terrified of death. His brother, is dying of consumption. In his home, Levin is so freaked out, he's paralyzed. He can't stand to be around his dying brother, whereas his wife, Kitty, is taking care of the brother. And it strikes Levin, who have studied philosophy and know everything, philosophers, right? Know nothing compared to my wife, Kitty, be quiet, because she's not petrified of death. She knows exactly what must be done. Gerasim is similar. Gerasim, other than Ivan's son, is the only one who touches him. He holds his legs. Gerasim reestablishes a contact by holding his legs between Ivan and the origins of life and the earth. He's like Antaeus, right? Who, as long as his feet were in contact with the earth, he had the vitality and the strength of the earth. And when you read literary texts, people who have problems with their feet, their legs, Richard III, Ahab, have a spiritual problem too. I mean, it's a common motif. So Gerasim doesn't lie. Gerasim takes care of him. Gerasim is kind to him, recognizes he's dying, leads him to ask, well, what then is life? What then is death? The one other character who touches Ivan is his son, Vasya. It's like, 8 or 9 years old. And ultimately, as Ivan finally is, he's lying there and he's dying. He knows he's dying. And finally it occurs to him, it wasn't the right thing. What I had thought was life is not life at all. What then is it? And as this question occurs to him, he feels his son kissing his hand. And as it's written, and then he beheld the light from the lips from his son on his hand. He comes to the realization that the light of meaning, the light of life, the sanctity of life, everything that makes life life lies in that loving contact, the loving expression of here I am. I'm right here for you. The peasant, Gerasim, is showing this to him, taking care of him, and in his final moment, the kiss from his son reveals to him the light, and then he passes on to the next world. I won't say he dies, but he passes on. So, by the grace of God, Iban, Yochanan, this is revealed to him, and it says that on the dead man's face there was a look of reproach and a warning. He's the prophet. Eliyahu, Elijah. Those who come before him are now summoned to another path of reproach and a warning. Let me end with a memory, if I can get it out. A very close friend of mine who passed away about 3 years ago at the age of 61. To me it sounds very young. A woman. My wife and I and other friends were with her in hospice for almost a week. We were with her in her last hours. And among her last words were, "We have so much to be grateful for." She died with words of thanksgiving on her lips. She was a sage. To know what to live for is to know what to be grateful for. To be grateful for being sent on a mission. Each morning, religiously observant Jews begin their consciousness by saying thank you. Thank you for sending me on another mission. Thank you for having confidence in me. Thank you for, even though I've screwed up every day till now, thank you for having faith in me to go out and do something for someone. Not thank you for another day to enjoy, but for something more to rejoice in. Something more to be grateful for. That's the life that comes to Iban Illich. That's the life of Iban Illich. Thanks. Question?
It's done.
Thank you very much. Well, what is your idea of the afterlife, and how is Iban Illich prepared? What's the next for you?
What is my idea of the afterlife? Well, I don't know. I mean, any idea we have of the afterlife is metaphorical. It isn't somewhere else or sometime else. It transcends the ontological coordinates that we work with. My idea of the afterlife is something like the Jewish idea of the afterlife, where we study Torah, we continue to learn, and with our learning we continue to engage the living. The relationship to others doesn't end with their passing on to from this world. If we have no meaningful relationship with the dead, we have no meaningful relationship with the living, in my view. So, my view is that it's that in the afterlife, in a way, we continue to watch over our loved ones from a larger perspective. So it's not some place we go to enjoy rewards. It's not a business transaction. I do X, I get paid off with Y. In my view, But again, I'm speaking metaphorically now. There's no other way to speak about this. Having said that, I would say that far more urgent than what it might become of me in the afterlife is what I must do in this life. God, the questions God puts to Cain is, where is your brother and what have you done? Not, where will you spend eternity? God doesn't ask that of Cain. It's, where is your brother right now and what have you done? I think that's a much more urgent matter than, what the afterlife might be. Now, I don't want to minimize it, but it's being here for someone else is a much more urgent matter, it seems to me.
Yes, sir.
Well, I just wanted to address that a little bit. I'm an old guy, but I have a 7-year-old daughter, and she's the light of my life. She, I can say honestly that she changed my life coming into the world. When she was about 4 years old, I was putting her to bed one night, and she started to cry. And I asked her why she was crying, and she said, "I'm beginning to forget heaven." And I said, "What is heaven like?" And she said, "Well, Daddy, you walk with God." And I thought in my heart, I want to walk with God. That's how she put it. But she was in touch with exactly what you were saying. That she was beginning to forget things, and she wanted to talk about them a little bit, to keep remembering them as best she could. And I've learned so much from her, very simple kind of notions, where she's spoken that to me. And it made me remember the things of my own childhood that I brought with me, those kinds of things. So, yeah, I find that quite profound in a way. And it's interesting to me, and I will end on this sort of as a comment, that in our society where we seem like we idolize you so much, we really hate them for their youth. If you look at what we're doing to them, where we're taking their childhood away from them repeatedly, 14% of our high school students, males, are on very heavy medication. I'm a clinical psychologist. Very heavy medications. Oh, I don't want that question.
I didn't interrupt you.
I
just want to throw out just an experience that I had, and you're talking on Nirvana, really it reminded me of this. My mother passed away 2 years ago. She was almost 88. And she was in hospice, and we were trying to get a hold of my brother, who was in the Arctic area hiking and camping, and he was expected back in 3 days, and she was in hospice, and she didn't really have the fear of dying, but she said, "I have to hold on until my brother returns." And unfortunately, that didn't last. But the other thing that I thought was so striking was that she knew she was about to die, and she was working on, she had a ball, and she was working on improving her hand strength. And she was like, I thought it was sort of contradictory that she was not, she didn't seem to be afraid of dying, she wanted to hold on for my brother to get back. But she was building, she was like trying to improve herself, trying to improve her physicality at the very end. And I just wanted to get your comments on that. It's like, it seems sort of a contradictory thing.
No, there's always, as long as we live, there's more to do. To live is to seek, to do, to realize more. It's the more. I've had the great blessing to have known some great scholars who, to their last day, had projects going. They didn't live long enough
to complete them. But it never occurred to them that they should retire or something. Although some of us retire in order to get some work done. So, I think that's meaning lies in the more. The more lies in the yet to be, what is not yet. And the sixth day, only the sixth day of creation, is called Tov Me'od. It's good, well, mistranslated, but it's good and more. It's when the more is introduced. Why? Because it's when human relation is introduced. In human relation, if you're just strengthening your hand, you're strengthening the hand that you extend to somebody else.
Yes.
So, and we all know this. We all live this. If you're married, you can't, and your wife says, you don't tell me you love me. I told you 6 months ago. No. It has to be reaffirmed. And each time we respond, we grow more responsible. It's more. So that's life. Life is the more.
That's very good. Question back here.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. for sharing your thoughts on the novel. Could you comment a little bit on that fascinating dynamic of the relationship between Yvonne and life as they went through this warfare in a way, struggle?
Well, yeah. The dynamic between Ivan and his wife. Tolstoy published The Death of Ivan Ilyich in 1886. After The Confession, published in 1879, he got religion, you might say. And he became increasingly estranged from his wife and all of his children except Alexander, one daughter. Most of what he published after 1881 was banned in Russia because he had become critical of the church, he had become critical of high society, the aristocracy, and his wife is from the aristocracy. His wife wants to be part of that club. And so Tolstoy, he looks like a nut from the outside, but he starts dressing in peasant clothes. He has a huge estate, huge house, but he's got this little room attached that he lives in himself. He is estranged from his wife because he viewed his wife as part of the high society game plan, and she wanted him to play that game. This is kind of the relation between Ivan Ilyich, and his wife, who calls him Jean. She won't even call him by his name. That's the lie that she is living in. And in some ways, it reflects Tolstoy's own relation with his wife.
Question back here.
Yeah, you talk about the corruption of a person in this context of the story. I'm wondering, could you comment on, if you were to look at the story in his life, who would bear the ultimate blame for him not discovering it until so late? And who would be able to look at that story and go, is it a societal thing, is it an individual thing? How could we avoid such corruption from the story?
Well, that's a good question. Tolstoy took responsibility for himself. He didn't blame anyone. Although when he tells us the story of his life, one of his early works is called Childhood. It's autobiographical. And he tells about, he had an aunt, who thought that when he was like 20, that he needed to have an affair with an older married woman just to introduce himself, to the world. So that every young man should have an affair with an older woman. And so he was in that Russian, the world of Russian aristocracy, and he bought into it. But having said that, he wrote, War and Peace came out in 1869. You've got all the spiritual struggles there, especially in the character of Pierre. But in 1863, when he's, 35, there's a character in a work called The Cossacks who's going through this same struggle.
more than 20 years before Ivan Illich. So this is a long story. From the time he was about 30, he began saying, hey, wait a minute, hey, wait a minute. And wrestling with it. And he, the brain never shifts anywhere outside of himself. You can't begin a movement of return to life until you take on that responsibility. Right? Maybe when he's 20, there are others, you know, channeling him along the proper way, the socially accepted way, and all of that. But by the time he's 30, he starts to raise questions himself.
It seems to me that the Russian writers like Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, you know, they do a really nice job getting into, like, you know, the soul of the man,
yeah,
personal turmoils. And life is an agrarian society, right? And now what we've seen in contemporary society, right around us in the industrial age, you have this strong element of the absurd, right? So you've got, like, Kafka's the trial. You've got Catch 22, all the absurdities there. And it seems like now in the modern West, it's no longer about the people. It's no longer a struggle of the soul. It's sort of like a struggle to just come to grips with a complex society we don't understand. And what I'm wondering is, am I missing something? Are there any good writers in the English world, and I'm saying English because Camus is French, you know, I can see it going to the stranger, but is there any good writer in the English world who gets into, like, the soul of humanity like the Russians do? I don't know.
Well, most of my current literary study is the study of Holocaust literature, and it's a literature of response to the ultimate horror, meaninglessness, darkness. Elie Wiesel's novels are very good. Andre Schwarzbard is excellent, The Last of the Just. But there, I mean, there is a, you know, that Holocaust context for that work. Having said that, and this is another long lecture, actually, but the horror anticipated by Dostoevsky, by Joseph Conrad, and that Camus lived through, came between 1933 and 1945. Now, we're still living in the aftermath of that. Still groping in a darkness, in the darkness of that shadow. One of the things that happens in the Holocaust, which is perpetrated by the most highly educated people on the planet, people with doctorate degrees, is that it calls into question the ground that Western civilization is based on. That ground starts to crumble. So there's a real scramble to somehow recover from that, if it can be recovered from. What especially troubles me is the relativization of truth and value, meaning, morality, so that, as some of my colleagues will say, there is no history, there are only narratives. There is no truth, there's only a narrative. Which, in the bottom line, means power is the only reality and weakness is the only sin. So that the horror is not that there's so much evil, but there is no evil, and there's no good. So the post-Holocaust writers address that horror. It's not just the absurd, it's the horror. Heart of Darkness, do you know this novel by Joseph Conrad, the film, Apocalypse Now? Kurtz dies, this is written in 1899. Kurtz dies, the renegade, who would be godlike dies repeating the words, the horror, the horror. This is often misread as, well, Kurtz came to realize how much evil humans are capable of. No. Kurtz came to realize that there is no evil. There's no good. There's simply what is. It's neutral. It's empty. It's meaningless. That's the horror. Except that now, if I could add something to that, I think in some quarters, to me, the horror is that no one's horrified. Yes.
Question here.
Yeah, this may be getting off to someone's question. He's asking almost like a comparative lit question across nations. And I was thinking the same thing about, say, Dickens' Christmas Carol, which, though we think of it as jovial Christmas, I think, well, it does get into the soul of man. It gets into some of the questions you're talking about, the so-called innocence of youth, where, you know, he goes back to when he was a kid, he hadn't been corrupted,
yeah,
hadn't been
yeah.
bitter. But there's a very big difference between the outcome of, you know, the stereotypical Russian novel, where it is a little bit somber and sad, versus Christmas Carol, where there's sort of a hope for the future, that sort of thing. And yet, following your kind of post-Holocaust horror thing, you know, in English literature, we've got Nobel Prize winning book Lord of the Flies, where, maybe even childhood itself isn't so innocent, and believe me, it's not, you know, original sin, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm kind of wondering what you think generally, if you think of other nations like France, Italy, other, even maybe Asia, such as Japan, I hate to think what you key and machine could have come up with, but something that gets into the soul of man and is maybe a little less somber than the Russian school and a little less optimistic than the Christmas Carol.
Well, less optimistic doesn't mean hopeless, right? At least as I see it. In France, one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century is a philosopher of meaning. Where does meaning lie? It's Emmanuel Levinas. Did I give a talk on Levinas here in one of my previous talks?
Maybe not.
I don't know if I could. Levinas is the voice of ethics that arises in response to Heidegger. Do you know Heidegger? Levinas proceeds with the principle that ethics is first philosophy. Anything that you determine philosophically has to derive from an ethical premise, from the good. And his thinking addresses human responsibility, human relation. It's not exactly like Uber in a number of ways, because he takes the other person to be in a position of height, whereas Uber talks as if you're both on the same level. Levinas says the other human being takes precedence over me. We're not on the same level. So I see it as a voice of meaning, mission, future, the yet to be. I see that in more at Levinas than in the French literary figures. French literature, I don't know. I'm not an authority on French literature, although it was one of the literatures I studied in my comp lit program. At least through the 60s and 70s, it struck me as bankrupt. The nouveau roman, right, the new novel, and the unraveling of literary forms, the advent of French literary theory. Someone once asked me, I was on a panel about, you know, dealing with humanities, if I thought that teaching business French is damaging to the study of French literature. And I said, no. Teaching French literary theory is damaging to the study of French literature. People started throwing things at me.
Okay.
That's not much help.
I think it's great. I'm a
I'm
politician, and I've seen many patients toward the end of their life, elderly ones, sort of give up and say, I'm tired. Is this, you know, Kubler-Ross's last phase, or have they just kind of, they're not living anymore, their life is already in the past, and they've come to this, you know, I give up, I'm at peace, and they usually say, I'm tired. Is this what Ganasim has helped Ivan to kind of, to cut from that realization?
Gerasim knows he's tired. This is why Gerasim holds his legs. I mean, he holds him. He comforts him. I mean, the thing, I totally respect Kubler-Ross's work, but the thing that makes me a little nervous is that we reduce what this person's going through to a clinical study. So the person becomes like a specimen, which is, I'm not saying Kubler-Ross wants to go there, but that's the temptation. Because if the person is, if it's a case study, or the person is a specimen, then the person is an it, and it doesn't implicate me. I don't have to deal with it. Yes, I know, they say, I'm dying. I've seen people saying, my parents are calling me. My parents need me. You may have experienced this as well. They're transitioning. Before they're gone, they're transitioning. And it seems to me what it's called for is not to say, oh, you're in this stage of dying, but to hold their hand or talk to them. According to the hospice physician, when I described this friend of mine who passed, the hospice physician said, she can hear you. Talk to her. And I don't know, how would one know, but she told us that the hearing is one of the last things to go. And sure, I would talk to her, her family would talk to her, and when we talked to her, her toes would move. When someone has passed on, in Jewish tradition, perhaps some of you know, we don't leave the body unattended. And it's not just that we stay with the body. We talk to the person. I'm right here. I know you're going through a difficult transition. Don't worry. Your loved ones are here. We're here to comfort you. And so until that person is in the ground, you continue not just taking care of the body, but you talk to that soul. So even after they're gone, so as they're going, hold their hand, talk to them. Be like Gerasim. Don't try to assess, well, you're in this stage, you're in that stage. And certainly don't try to tell them, look, this, you're going through something that everybody goes through, like, it's not everybody, it's this one, here, right? I don't have to tell you. You know more about that than I do.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question.
Your talk reminded me of the saying, when money is the only measure, virtue becomes a commodity. And
yes.
And today, our social interaction is most often mediated through social media. What did the death of Iran tell us about a modern state, a modern society?
It tells us to be afraid, be very afraid. Facebook is the opposite of the face.
Yep.
Friends. None of your friends is on Facebook. All the friends on Facebook, they're not your friends. Your friends are the people you engage, you touch, you're face to face with, you help, you give them something to eat. You can't offer a piece of bread to someone on social media. It's It's a counterfeit persona. It's not the soul. And it troubles me that to the extent that it eclipses human relation, it feeds into the death. What is the death of Ivan Illich? It's the counterfeit that he had mistaken for life. It's a counterfeit. It's a lie. It's useful. You know, you like to be able to text your daughter, "Are you okay?" Or you know, if you those of you who have had teenagers who are starting to drive, and you're paralyzed with fear, you like to have a way to connect with them. Can you imagine when some of you were teenage drivers, your parents had no way to connect with you? They must have been going nuts. But it's very dangerous. It's not. It's like fire. It has some good uses, but as soon as it starts to take the place of the relationship, then it feeds into a spiritual death.
That's right.
Let's give another round of applause.